Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Hello and welcome to episode 53 of the Chills of Will podcast. I am honored and privileged to be joined by Cassandra Lane. Born and raised in Louisiana, editor-in-chief Cassandra Lane, editor-in-chief of LA Parent Magazine, she made the transition from LA, Louisiana, to LA, Los Angeles in 2001. She was recently community relations manager for Los Angeles Dodgers, where she learned to cheer on her team like a real Angelino. She has also served as a newspaper reporter, high school English and journalism teacher, college application advisor, and senior writer for a nonprofit committed to improving the quality of early care and education for LA County children. She and her husband are having fun raising their son, who, depending on the day, wants to be an astrophysicist, artist, and video game developer. She has a BA in journalism and an MFA in creative writing from Antioch University. Her writings have appeared in a number of publications, and We Are Bridges, a memoir, is set to be published on April 20th of this year. That is so exciting. And welcome again officially. We talked a little about before. How is it to be this good busy? I know you got less than a month before the memoir comes out. What's life like right now?
Well, first of all, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much, Pete, for the invitation and that great introduction. It is really overwhelming right now. A friend told me yesterday that her executive coach coined the phrase crisis of overwhelm, and you can have a crisis of overwhelm even in the midst of great news, emotions, et cetera. It doesn't mean that there's any less stress. I'm very grateful. I'm very grateful, very honored to be in this position, but definitely it's a big cloud. It's interesting. I feel like I'm in a cloud, but at the same time moving forward. So hopefully on the other end of that, it will all look good.
Yes. We'll talk a little bit later about the actual memoir, but you know, congratulations. I can imagine seeing your name on a book cover, on a book spine, book jacket, whatever you call it, has got to be unbelievable, no matter how many times it happens, right? There it is. Give us a good shot of that again, if you would.
This is my, I got a box of author copies early. Oh my gosh. And it surprised me because they didn't tell me they were coming. It was so exciting.
What a great surprise. Wow. How did I do on the intro? I know you've had a lot of different, worn a lot of different hats. Anything that you want to update or anything that was left out on the bio?
You pretty much captured everything I've been up to over these last several years. I would say with my son though, he's always updating month to month. Okay. So I don't know if the astrophysicist is still on the list, but definitely he's moving more and more into the creative field. So he's an artist. We'll just see.
Very cool. So growing up in LA, which was Louisiana, you know, what were you reading? Was it a print rich environment? Were you somebody who read everything that the teacher gave you? Were you somebody who said, I'm going to read on my own, kind of do my own list? What was really interesting you as a kid and as far as what you were reading?
So I grew up in a very tiny town. We didn't even have any bookstores. We did have our parish library, and I loved reading. I loved watching my mom read her romance novels. And when I was around probably 11, I started sneaking and reading them too. So engrossed, and I wanted to know what is in those things.
Sure.
But you know, it really was, and I don't even know if we had a bookshelf in the house. My mom would have, you know, her boxes of books. I grew up in a very religious household, and my uncles were the preachers, and we had Bible study almost every night. Even when we weren't in church, we had Bible study in the home. So there was always, you know, the reading of the Bible and that rich language, oral histories, preaching. And so, and my mom plays the electric guitar. And so there was just always, I think, this texture of language and music. And I grew up just with my ear fine-tuned to all of that.
Sure.
And it was a five-generation household that I grew up in.
Wow.
So listening, I was very timid, but I was always in some corner listening to the adults and their conversations. And then I love to read the dictionary and the encyclopedias, World of Knowledge book. And so I would just read that page to page. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just from a young age, just your typical fairy tales. Mm-hmm. I read all the Nancy Drew books, Judy Blume. And then as I got older, Stephen King. I became obsessed with Stephen King.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, I remember reading The Stand and having nightmares.
Yes.
But couldn't stop.
Well, I love the imagery of, you know, of you in the corner, not like in a negative way, but just listening and just being an observer. And that definitely leads to storytelling, right? I mean, you hear the stories and you're able to put them on paper later on. What the term parish, I know I think of with New Orleans, but I guess maybe that's Louisiana as a whole. What is a parish, like a county or?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
That's all right. That's all
right. And it's the only state that still calls it a parish. Right. So parish is county.
Okay.
Louisiana holds on to its traditions.
Right.
Yeah.
And you talk about the Bible, which of course is the best-selling book in the history of the world, right? Did you on your own, or were you taught to see it as literature, as an achievement of human writing, or was it more like strictly in a religious sense? Does that make sense?
I think mostly in a religious sense, although my uncle Junior, who was the head preacher, he was very poetic in the way he broke down. And there was a lot of annotating, he's passed on, but he died in January of 2020, and we went to his funeral, and my aunt was showing me one of his Bibles, and it was just so tattered, and notes, sticky notes everywhere, you know, annotations. And so he just broke down all the symbolism. He would have dreams and visions himself and then interpret them. So there was a lot of annotation and interpretation in the church services and in the Bible studies. Mm-hmm. And so even though we weren't calling that literature, that was a tradition that I grew up in. And that just connected once I got into my first literature classes. It's like, oh yeah, we do this.
Right, this is fun.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear about his passing. But yeah, again, with that image of just the colorful Bible, like you talk about, like post-it notes type of things. And yeah, I mean, I think our preachers, our ministers, our priests are definitely some of our first teachers.
Absolutely.
Right. And I mean, obviously the speech thing, I was a shy kid, but I could always, you know, my grandpa being a deacon, I always was fairly comfortable in front of a microphone.
That's so interesting.
Right? Even though I was shy as heck with anyone else. Well, thank you for sharing that. As you got a little bit older, high school, college, who you talk, you know, like Stephen King, et cetera, who were those ones who gave you chills at will? Those ones who thrilled you, those ones who you still remember to this day, you maybe even go back and reread.
Oh,
the thrilling ones. Yeah.
Yeah. So at 11, I told my mom that I would be a writer. She tells me that. I don't know if I remember saying it myself or she's just told me that so many times over the years, because it's definitely like lodged in my memory.
Right.
So I said that, but I didn't have any examples of any Black writers, any Black authors. I hadn't studied any Black authors, you know, from K through 12th grade. I remember loving Scarlet Letter. That was one of my favorite novels in high school. In AP English and et cetera, but I didn't take my first African-American literature class until probably my sophomore, junior year of college. And I remember being absolutely blown away by Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon, just what she does with language in that book. And then James Baldwin's Go Tell It on the Mountain, you know, the character's very religious family, his preacher father, it felt like my family. And so it was just fascinating to be introduced to these texts and to wonder, oh my gosh, these were published before I was born and I didn't know about them. So it was very revelatory. It was very affirming. And it just instilled in me this desire to, yes, I can be a writer. And I'm going to pursue this. Wow. So of course, Toni Morrison and James Baldwin are two people that I return to, like many of us, over and over again.
Yes,
absolutely.
When you talked about like kind of like discovering them, like you said, obviously they've been writing even before you were born, but did you feel like you'd lost out as a kid, like maybe not necessarily seeing, you know, characters like yourselves and what you're reading, or I guess, like, were you cognizant of it, of that at the time when you were reading earlier on, like, hey, I don't necessarily see a lot of people like me, or was that something that was kind of subtle and you didn't necessarily hit you till later?
Yeah, I think it was subtle. I always felt, you know, awkward and on the outside of everything. And even though I loved reading, I wasn't necessarily, you know, I would say reading Judy Blume's books did make me feel understood because they were adolescents. And so I could relate to those sort of, you know, generic adolescent issues, being an adolescent girl. But in terms of, you know, there were no discussions of race, those kind of battles. Definitely, I hadn't consciously thought about that, but I would say, yeah, it was underneath the surface.
Right. So when did you, as a writer, say, or people told you that you finally said, like, wow, I can do this. Like, I'm good at this. People are going to read what I write.
I would say that first African-American lit class gave me that, you know, that feeling, that sense of empowerment. Mm-hmm. And the professor, the way the professor was invested in the artists that we studied. I just could imagine myself being, you know, a writer who wrote books. Mm-hmm. I decided to change my major, being, you know, ever conscious, from English literature to journalism, because I didn't know how to bridge, you know, the gap. And I knew I was practical enough to realize I wasn't going to graduate and become this best-selling novelist, et cetera. So I liked journalism enough. I had taken a couple of classes. I decided to major in it and change my minor to English lit. Mm-hmm. And that's the route that I took into the writing world. Mm-hmm. I became the editor-in-chief of the campus newspaper. I then did an internship at the local metropolitan newspaper, and that paper hired me after college. And so that's what I spent my 20s doing, is newspaper reporting, honing my chops, working with editors, which was a great training ground.
Right.
I love the editing process and very much appreciate and value the editing process because I've been working with editors for so long, and it's a true art form.
Do you have any of those early stories that you wrote for the newspaper?
I do. I knew I was in my closet earlier, like, you really need to throw some of this stuff away. But it's hard to, you know, because that was before everything was archived online. So we had the newspapers, we had newspaper librarians who are just, oh my gosh, so valuable.
Oh yeah.
I remember them. They could fish out an article no matter how long ago it had happened. Mimi was one librarian that I remember very fondly. So I have a lot of those old newspaper clippings. This is the 90s.
Yeah.
Where I was working full time as a staff writer. So yes, I absolutely do.
I mean, would you agree that, like, there may not be a profession on earth where the people love it more than librarians?
Oh, I absolutely agree.
And I think it's a different level, right? I think it's a different level. Like, you talk about those who, you know, go into how do you pronounce it? Microfiche. Mm-hmm. You know, like those type of librarians. I mean, when they were showing you around to the Dewey Decimal System and all that, like, just love and
power. Oh, they love it. Yes. They absolutely love it.
So true. In 2021, or, you know, in recent years, of course, the greats you talk about with Morrison and James Baldwin, who have been some other contemporary writers, and I'm sure you have a long, long list, but
yes,
who are some that continue to inspire you?
So many that I was like, okay, I'll jot some down. Jasmine Ward, I mean, she's younger than I am, but already a classic and has been absolutely genius. Sharon Olds, I love reading Sharon Olds, especially The Father. I don't write poetry, but I, you know, treasure them because they help us in our prose, just refine, play around with language. Mm-hmm. Terrence Hayes, and I was in a workshop in New Orleans with Terrence Hayes, Jericho Brown, and Yona Harvey.
What? Name?
I'm so jealous. I learned so much.
That's
from
awesome.
And the workshop was, you know, it was prose writers, fiction, nonfiction, as well as poets, spoken word artists. Mm-hmm. And it was founded and led by our mentor, Kalamu Yasalam. Another one that I have to give complete credit to, as far as, because I was working as a newspaper journalist, I found this Black writers group, and it just, it liberated me in so many ways, like mentally.
Oh, yeah.
emotionally, creatively, and to hear, you know, it was one thing to study the greats in that class that I spoke of, and another to be in the midst of these young people who were all in their 20s, writing Kalamu. I did not want to perform my work, but he made me, pushed me to get in front, you know, behind the podium and read. So we had our community readings at like the Community Book Center, Tennessee Williams Festival. It was like, it was a really rich, exciting time. And listening to those poets like Terrence, like Jericho, recite their poetry. It's like, it was like listening to my mom play the guitar, you know. It was just, it gets into your bloodstream, and it shows up in your writing in ways that you don't even know later.
Well, hopefully the inauguration 2025, hopefully Jericho Brown gets to do that one.
Yes.
I mean, Amanda Gordon was great.
She was. Absolutely.
And I heard Jericho was also in the running too. So maybe he gets 2025.
Yeah. So wonderful.
I might be skipping a couple years, but I know you were also a high school teacher. I wonder what were some of the texts that you really enjoyed teaching? This was at the high school level, I'm correct?
It was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What were some of the texts that you really enjoyed? And maybe just as important, what were some of the texts that your students really enjoyed or got a lot out of?
Yeah. So the first school that I taught at was an alternative school for 14 to 21 year olds who were either on probation or had been on probation for everything from petty, you know, petty stuff to felonies. And I kind of approached that as with a mixture of, you know, music and language, smaller texts. I remember the biggest pieces that we started reading were some Shakespeare pieces, Macbeth, Julius Caesar, and the kids were some of them, you know, had been in gang-related, were in for gang-related stuff. And I remember them being so resistant, for instance, when we read Julius Caesar, and with the language, you know, it was a barrier. They were like, what is this now? And they ended up being really, you know, over time, as we broke it down very slowly, just really identifying with the characters, critiquing the characters, acting it out. It was amazing. So I would mix kind of using language, teaching these texts with music, bringing in Curtis Mayfield. We analyze We the People, Who Are Darker Than Blue. It was just, and related that to our lives. There was a lot of flexibility and creativity that I was able to do as at that time as an assistant teacher with my lead teacher, and I learned so much from those kids and from those teachers. And then the second school that I taught, so I taught only about a total of five and a half years. The second school was not far from me now, on Crenshaw Boulevard at View Park Prep Charter High School. And there I taught with Mike Songson. We ended up hiring Mike probably about a year after I started. He taught poetry. I taught English Lit and journalism. And some of the texts that I remember just really, and this was around 2000, from 2006 to about 2009 at that school. They loved Catcher in the Rye, A Raisin in the Sun. We really spent a lot of time with A Raisin in the Sun. We read the play, acted out the play. We watched the film, Master Harold and the Boys, Fences. Again, Fences just like A Raisin in the Sun. Again, Macbeth as well, Romeo and Juliet, Great Gatsby. Those are some pieces that stick out in my memory. We had a lot of those.
What are your thoughts on the idea that, like, you know, kids, quote unquote, kids don't read anymore?
I think we just have to find the books that speak to them, you know, and take away their phones. So I have a 13-year-old, and he used to, I have to be honest, he used to love reading. He would fall asleep surrounded by 10 different books, reading them all at the same time. Yeah. And now it's a little bit of a struggle. Like, okay, it's reading time because the phone has so much, you know, on it, the phone and the computers. And so there's a constant competition between instantaneous and social media, as opposed to the slowness that it takes to pick up a book and to sink into it and to read. One thing that my husband and I need to come back to is sitting down and saying, this is our reading hour, family time. Because again, kids do what they see us do. It does no good if I'm closed up in my writing room and reading, or in the bedroom if he's not seeing it. And the same thing with my husband, if he's reading at night and he's So that's, I think we can come alongside of our kids and read with them.
Sure.
Jay, I love what a lot of the YA authors like Jason Reynolds are doing right now, you know, doing stuff online with these live talks, mm-hmm. finding ways to talk to kids on their level, mm-hmm. but then they have these really beautiful, you know, novels that yeah. kids can relate to as well. So mm-hmm. I think a combination of that, reading together with our kids, introducing them to authors like Jason Reynolds, who can speak their language,
right.
and then making sure that they feel seen and heard in the books sure. that they're reading.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm taking notes. I've got an almost 5-year-old and a 3-year-old, and I, you know, so I'm taking notes, which is a great transition into your work with LA Parent yeah. magazine. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got started there and what your duties are?
Absolutely. So I met one of the publishers when I was still working for that early education nonprofit. At mm-hmm. the time, it was called LA Up. It's now Child 360 in downtown. Oh, yeah. And Elena, you know, was always looking for opportunities to partner with different organizations, institutions. So somehow we got connected, had lunch, talked about ways that the magazine could partner with Child 360, mm-hmm. and, or what stories Child 360 had to tell about early education. We just really hit it off. We were talking about kids. But, you know, at the time I was the senior writer for this nonprofit. From there, I went on to the Dodgers and was a community mm-hmm. relations manager over there. It was a great, great time, but I only yeah. spent about a year and a half because it was truly a lot, you know,
okay.
7 days sometimes. and I did some writing like for their magazine, et cetera. And so at one point, as I was thinking about what was next, I found out that LA Parent had an opening for a managing editor. Mm. And it was just I reached out to them, we talked, did the interviews, and I got the job. And it was a great way for me to get back into writing more full time, learned sharpening editing, you know, chops. And it gave me a little bit more time to work on my own creative work as well. So as managing editor and now editor in chief, which happened just in January, I work with a ton of local writers and even writers outside of LA. Mm-hmm. I knew so many writers already because I'm part of the literary community. So I've been able, and that's one of my favorite parts, being able to bring in writers who are parents. We're a parenting magazine, but it's not just about parents. We write about sure. arts, culture, and theater, nature, so much. So I just love working with this diverse, robust list of writers, mm-hmm. what they bring to the magazine. So I, you know, solicit their work, I assign work, I edit their work, I write, I do a lot of writing myself, mm-hmm. partner with so many various aspects of the community, from Hollywood to the medical field, because we're constantly, you know, sourcing our stories, of course, mm-hmm. but also soliciting guest columns to get, mm-hmm. I get a million pitches a day from,
I bet,
you know, New York publishing houses, medical field, Hollywood. mm-hmm. There are a lot of intersections at this one magazine that yeah. initially, I don't think I even thought about it. I thought, oh, wow, I'm going to go and write about family and parenting. And yes, that's a huge part of it. But there are so many other industries that intersect with that.
Well, congrats on the promotion.
Thank you.
Awesome. Do you have to do a lot of like the promotion and like the business side of it? Or are you more the writing, the creative part?
All editorial and social media. I oversee okay. the social media. So I'm promoting okay. in that way, you know, all of our content and also and sharing and sometimes jumping on IG Live and doing things. We want to do a consistent children's reading hour, or it won't be an hour, but a children's okay. reading section to have sure. children's book authors and YA authors come on and read.
Nice. We've
done a little bit of that, but I'd love to do more of that.
Uh-huh.
Especially during the pandemic, we only printed 2 magazines during 2020, that first year. So we already had a digital magazine, but that forced us right. to really invest more in that product,
mm-hmm.
to let people know about it, because a lot of people, they're so used to seeing us in print, they didn't even know that we had a digital magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So we really, and using social media, we really just increased our digital presence, and it opened up so much in our social media channels and so mm-hmm. many new partnerships, which is great.
That is great. Would you say it's more geared towards parents of I know you said it's not all about parenting, but more parents of like kids and toddlers, or more like adolescent teenagers, or is it good? Is it a mix of all of the above?
Our goal is zero to college prep. So yeah, absolutely. In fact, our cover models for the next issue, they're expectant parents, first time expectant.
Oh, nice.
So she's going to be pregnant on the cover and the dad's. So we're excited about that. I don't think we've had a cover like that, not in recent years. So we'll be talking to them. We just started a podcast.
All right.
We'll be launching. So we're doing the recordings now. And so we're talking to them about, they're both news anchors. We're talking to them about what do they expect, you know, as expectant parents and just how they're preparing and what's the best and worst advice they've gotten, because we know how people pester expectant parents.
Right.
But well, we all do articles of, you know, college preparation, college tips, college. So everything and everything in between.
Well, it's cool to see you use all your skills. I mean, you know, you talked about you were working with college applications and early childhood education and all the above, and going in the podcast. I guess it's kind of the way of media now, right? So you have you have to be a multimedia. If you're not, you're getting left behind.
You totally will. I've seen with so many print publications.
Talk a little bit about your writing. On your website, you've got some great samples.
Thank you.
Some great short pieces. I'm going to talk about one that's called The Seeker and the Artist.
Mm.
And that is, now that is that part of the memoir, or is that something that's separate?
That's not at this point. And the memoir has seen so many before. So maybe it was at one point, but it's definitely not in the final book. So that's the lone essay.
I guess it would be fair to say that the girl who's you, right, is kind of the beginning is teased at school for fashion. It was kind of more religious and safe than stylish, maybe. There's a great quote, "Before sixth grade, I didn't belong to the world and didn't know how to act in it. I'd seen an angel, traced God's face in the clouds, manifested the spirit in church. In church, Uncle Junior told us how to have a relationship with God, how if we didn't, we'd surely die and forever burn the lake of fire. But he didn't teach us how to have relationships with each other," unquote. I think a lot of us can identify with this idea of like the secular world and the religious world. But then there's your sister, who seems to be a lot more at ease with the world. I kind of wonder how that relationship worked out in those days where, like I said, she did seem to be more worldly. Not necessarily in the negative sense, and you maybe not so much. How did that kind of shake out and work out living under the same roof?
Yeah, wow, that's a good question. And it definitely is accurate. And I guess I wonder how much of it has to do with birth order. I'm the oldest, you know, and so I think kind of typically you have more burdens on your shoulders. I was and she used to call me Miss Goody Two Shoes, and she felt freed from having to try to be that Miss Goody Two Shoes. And so people kind of held me up as, you know, the good one, the one who got good grades, and her as, oh, that girl, you know, she's a headache, she's this, and she got more whippings. And so unfortunately, you know, we both were living out these archetypes, and there was a lot of tension because of that. But yeah, she was free in a lot of ways from those sort of, some of them self-imposed expectations, and then family and community. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate the long answer and the short answer. The long answer makes a lot of sense. The short answer, birth order, is like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense too. That rings very true, huh? And, you know, not necessarily that it means losing faith, but I think a lot of us can identify with the idea of you in this piece start to question the infallible truths of Uncle Junior, of just the church in general, right? And then the one of the really interesting incidents is that you find the forbidden astrology book. Right, which seems like it's totally just anathema to the religious sense, right?
Right, and it was in my mom's one of those boxes where the romance books. It's so interesting, you know.
was it kind of the idea of how someone don't open that door over there and make someone open the door? Was it a lot of that?
Yeah, I wanted to know, why are all these boxes, dusty boxes, in the closet in the back? And it felt very juicy and secretive and mysterious to me. And so I would sneak, while she was at work, I would sneak in there and and flip through them. And one day as I was flipping through, there was this lid book with no book jacket, and I was fascinated by it. I was fascinated.
And so then you kind of like are, you know, get some, even some more popularity at school, right? Kind of reading it out of it and telling people about it.
But there's it's like this mystic power that I have. I understand you and I can tell you about yourself.
Are you still into astrology, would you say?
I just still find, use it as a symbol, you know, it's, I love the symbolism in it. It's, you know, it's closely tied to mythology.
Sure.
So I love anything that's tied to imagery and symbolism and metaphor.
That's cool. And then, you know, I mean, it's a fairly short piece, but there's so much good stuff packed into it. There's Dina, is that how you, that's your sister, right? Is that she has her own resistance, right? And she, unfortunately, later in life was a domestic violence victim, but really talks about her overcoming and really finding self-empowerment through art. And then there's a beautiful repetition at the end that's talking about her overcoming those struggles, et cetera. And it's, and she did. And she did. And, you know, I think we all know that repetition can be repetitive and redundant, but it can also be beautiful because it really builds. And it's a really, really nice way to end that piece.
Thank you.
The seeker and the artist. So in what ways were you the seeker, or were you also the artist?
Yeah, I think when I think back to the titling of that, before it was called The Red Book and who knows what else. but I think once I settled on that title, when it was published, I see us both as seekers. I think probably growing up, I saw myself as the, you know, she was the tomboy. She was actively doing, and I never remember seeing her with the book. So I saw myself as the refined, observant reading, but she was seeking in her own way. And it took some bumps. It takes all of us trials and bumps, but she was seeking in her own way. She came to find out that she was an artist, you know, at, I don't know, 30. We didn't even know that she could draw, and she started drawing. And then from there, it went to, let me see what I can do with a chunk of wood. And she started carving these figurines. Then she started making furniture, tables. Wow. So just because her journey looked different than mine, didn't make her any less, you know, curious and observant. So I would say that we both were, and I, you know, I'm an artist in the sense, you know, words and the page. So yeah, both of us, I think, in our own ways, are seekers and artists.
Well, I mean, I even feel a little like embarrassed or shy sharing some of these things. I mean, obviously you put them into your work, so, you know, the public knowledge and all that, but I just wonder about, and we're about to get into some even more really serious and tragic events. The idea of writing about your family, was that at first really hard, or was that something that you felt was like healing or had to be done?
I think, so it started first, I was writing about everyone else, you know, as a journalist. And then I had a bi-monthly column at the first newspaper. And in that column, I loved writing profiles, telling people's stories. And so over time, I just started thinking, okay, this is great, but what is my story? What is my family story? Who's recording them? Who's listening to them? Who's in some way immortalizing their voices? And so I think the first piece that our family piece that I did was on my grandmother, beloved grandmother, my mother's mother. She had passed 2 or 3 months before I was graduating from college. And it was devastating because she was, I was going to be the first one. And she was so proud and so excited. And I was sad that she didn't get a chance to see that. At the time, I was the editor of the campus newspaper, and I believe that's the first piece that I wrote about a family member that was published. And I got letters from students, but I also ended up getting some letters from adults in the community.
Wow!
For that piece, and it was validating. Like this woman who grew up poor, Black in the South, has a story, and it's valid, and people want to know more about her. So I would say that was the seed of just validating my people through the written language and wanting to do more of that.
You know, another piece that can be found on your website is White Oak, which is fiction. Is that was the whole piece that was included on the site, right?
So that piece actually is part of the longer book.
Okay.
We Are Bridges. And We Are Bridges, yes, it's a memoir, but there are fictionalized elements based on the little pieces of fact that I know about my grandfather.
I mean, the fiction on its own, you know, whether or not, if I were to just read it and not know that it were related to your personal story, would be incredibly affecting and upsetting and and emotional. Is Bert, so Bert was your great grandfather?
Yes, so Bert was my great grandfather who was lynched around 1904 in Mississippi.
You write, you know, which is, I mean, just very interesting on a story level, is that you write fiction based on kind of what you know about it. It sounds like you, at the time, even maybe still now, don't know a lot of details.
Absolutely, Rick.
Mm-hmm. And so he's a shopkeeper. He refuses intimidation. They're trying to, the white leadership is trying to make him sell, right, so that they can have room for the railroad. And, you know, the parts that are so obviously upsetting is just how little of a quote unquote mistake, which wasn't even a mistake on his part, led to him being lynched. One of the quotes from the piece is, quote, "Bert wonders why they're being so discreet, since most lynchings take place in the middle of these southern towns where courage builds under the wild eyes of mobs," which unfortunately that line has been true throughout history. You see it with the insurrection, you see it with all the lynchings that happened. There's the beautiful and beautiful, it could be, but heartbreaking, the idea of safety in the womb, right? That the hope of the baby girl who was going to be born to Bert. Am I correct on that?
So, baby son.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry.
Grandfather.
Right. And I'm sorry. The part about the baby girl was that there was a hope that she would be, that the baby would be a girl, so that she could avoid some pain of being of males who are overwhelmingly, or were, you know, victims of racist violence. Married, your great-grandmother witnessed the after effect. It's just incredibly upsetting and talks about these ideas of historical trauma, right, and shared pain. I can imagine it would have been very upsetting for you to write it. What brought you to bring it in a fictionalized sense?
So I don't think I knew about the lynching until I was in college or about to go to college. Because Grandma Mary, and I remember her very well. I was 11 when she died, and she lived with us because she was in her 90s, and she got too old to stay on her farm. And she moved in. So like I said, it was five generations of us. After my mom's divorce, we all lived in this one little house. So I just remember her. I remember her tea cakes. I remember her snuff. I remember her sleeping in her old recliner. I remember her shooing away ghosts. So she was like this relic, animated and confusing to me as a kid. But in college, I heard Billie Holiday sing Strange Fruit, a recording of her singing Strange Fruit for the first time. And I was haunted by it. And I don't know at what point, but, you know, found out that somebody in our family was lynched and that it was Grandma Mary's, the love of her life. She did marry a man who was very abusive to her and to her and Bert's son, my Papa Houston. And I also remembered my grandfather, Papa Houston, crying in his 80s in his recliner about his father and how he never knew his real daddy, and his stepdaddy beat him so bad because he wasn't his. And now it just, again, I was always lurking and listening. And so in college, listening, you know, taking my first classes where books were dealing with those issues, listening to over and over to Billie Holiday sing Strange Fruit, I started to become interested in that family history. But I didn't start trying to tell the story until I was 30 and had left Louisiana and moved out to California. And I think it was a way, and I was working through a lot of my own personal issues, and I went to therapy and just started and knew, I mean, I understood that, you know, we are the way we are partly because of past trauma and joys too, that our family and blessings and all of that. But as I started writing, I started wanting to know more about my family. And I think maybe it was a way to kind of tether me, since I was out here in 2,000 miles away, no family. Yeah, I became obsessed first with Bert Bridges, what happened to him, why, because Grandma Mary didn't want to, she did tell us his name and that he was so beautiful. She, even on her deathbed, talking about how beautiful he was. She would cry and say, he was so, I loved him so much. He loved me. And then she would say, I don't want to say anymore. The white people hated him and they thought he was uppity. And so we just had those seeds. And when I started looking at records, it happened in or around Holmesville, Mississippi, which is now a ghost town. Come to find out, all records were burned in some courthouse fire, from 1912 and earlier. I did hire briefly a historian in Mississippi who believed she found him on a census report. Mm. That's not in the book because the book ends before then. And
okay.
It's material that I'll explore for later. Mm. But we do believe that it's the same Bert Bridges. I did a DNA test and maybe found some distant cousins. So that's ongoing. Mm. But in terms of this book, I had those seeds that Mary was willing to give us and created a story for them anyway, because I didn't want to just capture the tragedy. I also wanted to capture or recreate for them this love and joy that they had.
That's amazing that you lived with her.
Yeah.
You talk about, I didn't know that the last name literally was Bridges. Wow. Mm-hmm. You talk about just the Bridges. Do you feel like you are better equipped than a lot of people to connect the dots between, that quote unquote really bad racism, which, people will claim. Obviously that has not been remedied even in 2021, but do you feel like you're really able to see the connections between, quote unquote, so long ago, 70, 80 years ago, and now because of the fact that you knew her, that you knew what she was like?
I do address that. Yes, absolutely. I won't say better equipped, but I definitely feel, that I've touched it. I touched her skin, and it was her skin touched his skin. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, 1904 sounds like a long time ago, but here you had in that same household, my great grandmother, my grandparents, my mother, who's part of, baby boomer generation, my sister Dina and I, we're Gen Xers. And then my younger siblings are millennials. You're talking about contemporary. We were all, and my younger siblings were born before Grandma Mary died as well. So we all touched her skin, and her skin again, was a part of Bert. Yeah. And they had a child together. So that's even more, it just feels more immediate to me maybe than someone who doesn't have that family history or don't know about family history.
Wow. So I got to think then that Familiar Fruit, which is also a short excerpt on the website, that's from the Billie Holiday song. Is it take off on the title?
Yes, it's a take on the title. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because is it strange if it was happening so often? In some ways. So I flipped that.
The writer's note there for that piece is, what is the relationship between the two? This marriage cut short by racial violence and the generational trail of broken marriages in its wake. Can family cycles be healed? Is that fair to say that that's a lot of what the memoir is about? About generational trauma, about the scars that are left over?
Absolutely. And the silence around those scars, because I don't think you can truly heal if you don't even know what the scars are, or if you're unwilling to examine them. Mm-hmm. So it's about the silence too. So there's, yes, there's the societal, there's looking at, this larger societal ill, but then what is our responsibility in terms of our own communication about it and our own healing and therapy? Mm-hmm. Outside of, in addition to our spiritual pursuits, religious pursuits, what kind of psychological work do we need to do?
So We Are Bridges is a memoir. It's coming out April 20th. Mm-hmm. So exciting. I know you've been doing a lot of the pre, work for it. Bridget Davis has I assume it'll be a blurb.
The blurb. I do have the blurb writers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's one of the blurb writers. She wrote The World According to Fannie Davis. And she writes, quote, in this evocative memoir, Cassandra Lane deftly uses the active imagination to reclaim her ancestor's story as a backdrop for telling her own. The tradition of Black women's storytelling leaps forward within these pages into fresh, daring, and excitingly new territory. How long has the process been of writing that book? Like your whole life? Or
I guess so in some ways. Several generations, because in some ways I do feel like it's a it's a collaboration. It is. I feel like spiritually, creatively, it's a collaboration, and it's beyond just me. In the past as well as future. What helped me pick the book back up, so going back to how long, I would say that I first started the first kind of seeds of it when I was in the MFA program at Antioch, around 2001, 2002.
Okay.
So just going all through my life journey, you know, working full time. And then I became a mom in 2007, really stopped writing for a while there, but picked it back up. I think a lot of the reason why I picked it back up was because of motherhood, and wanting my son to have a better life and wanting to not be silent about the things that were painful, you know, to give him, yes, that joy, but also an understanding of who his family was, where we came from.
Right.
So I definitely a bridge, bridging the, my aunts, and I knew he, you know, he would never meet my grandparents. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing. Yeah. There's the tragedy, but like, yeah, there's also the beautiful things that they, that they offered, that they talked about, the laughs. And so here we are way out here in California, and it, it pained me that he would never have those rich experiences as well. Right. So I was determined at some point, I became determined to finish it, to also give it as a gift to him.
Oh, that's beautiful. One of the excerpt I was able to read is, correct me if I'm wrong, it's, I don't know if it's actually the literal beginning of the book or not, but it's that spelling contest when you were a kid against Lloyd, and Lloyd's, you know, the blonde haired white kid doesn't seem to be, seems to be very serious and kind of taking some pleasure in you not doing so well, maybe. And, you know, you're somebody who's, like you said, very, you know, book smart and wanting to do really well, really competitive. And you say, better to not know what hanged me, which I think is referring to literally on the surface level is referring to what word you got wrong or which word he got correct to win it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But obviously, you know, there's a lot of symbolism there about the past and all of the above. Is that the beginning of the book, or what's the significance of that part?
Yeah. So it's not the beginning. It is around the big, it's in that first part, part one. So yeah, it's definitely, you know, in that first section of like setup, kind of going, and again, going back and forth in time, from adulthood to my adulthood to childhood and the ancestral past. So definitely in the first few chapters.
And then there you're writing about you being the first generation, maybe even the first of the family, like your siblings, to have to be in an integrated school, which obviously is very,
my mom went to segregated schools.
Wow. Yeah. Which again, tells us how, because you're so young.
I mean, I'm not that young.
You're so young, which again reminds us that, you know, it wasn't something that this racism thing wasn't like thousands of years ago or hundreds of years ago even. I was wondering maybe if you could, if there might be a piece of the memoir you want to read. And while you're looking for that, am I correct that Marcus is your husband?
Yes, he's my husband.
You were talking about, you know, the idea of having something for your son and for your family. You write, in looking back, quote, Marcus and I spoke often about our childhood memories, moments of feeling devalued, and we swore to shower our child with love and affirmations, impenetrable shields from the mental arrows that would one day come, long before we had to fear the path of bullet. I'm not going to mess it up by saying anything about it. It's beautiful on its own.
Thank you.
Just the idea of just, you know, a legacy of racism and all that came with it.
Right.
I said I wasn't going to say anything. Sorry.
Thank you so much for reading so deeply and beautifully. A memory. What feels like a memory comes to me. A white boy is writing his name, Lloyd, and mine on a blackboard, drawing a line between us. The chalk squeaks and strains against the board as the boy creates another long vertical line, his hangman's pole, and a series of short blank lines beneath it. He turns to me with a sneer and the most difficult phrase he can fathom locked in his head, which is covered with silvery blonde hair and filled with tricks. We are in second grade, and every year we stand next to each other when it's time to line up in alphabetical order. A veil of camaraderie has emerged from this mashup, but we are not really friends. I sit in the middle row, surrounded by vacant desks, praying that my brain will fill in all the blanks of Lloyd's person, place, or thing. I glance out the window where the rest of our classmates are running and squealing with delight, their faces glowing with sweat. Why have I chosen to spend my recess in a cold, quiet classroom filled with the grin stretching across Lloyd's face and the anxiety over losing, pinching at my chest? R, I call out the letter first because it seems to be a staple ingredient of most words, but there is no R and there is not even a T. None of the usual standbys apply. Letter by letter, the boy hangs my errors, drawing in the body parts of the little stick person, head first, then neck, then right arm. If this boy were just a teeny bit nice, he'd give me facial features and fingers. He'd bless me with a triangle skirt, endowing me with more time. I am stuck. I run out of the safe consonants and vowels. I feel caged and can sense my stomach sinking. Half of my stick body dangles on the edge of the pole as my opponent greedily waits to shout out my defeat. I sit frozen in my bone-hard seat, feeling myself diminishing centimeter by centimeter. The line extending from the expressionless, carved-out head on the blackboard is a vein in my neck. But how was I losing? How was I losing to this boy, a C student? I was the spelling bee champion. Our teacher, Mrs. Crane, had called me smart, and her praise had been like gold. Where is Miss Spelling Bee now? Lloyd teases as, time after time, he fills my stick body in on the chalked gurney. Hung, he rings. I picture a little silver bell dangling at the back of his throat. Hung, the word echoes through the room. Fear and saliva rise in my throat. The school bell rings. The other kids trickle back into the classroom, moist and happy. Lloyd does not offer the answer to his puzzle, and I do not ask. Better to not know what hanged me.
Thank you so much for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Wow. Just the, when you describe wishing that you'd been given, you know, hands and more features, that's very beautiful, sad, from a writer's sense, just so interesting. And the idea that you have this surface level thing going on, it could be an innocent game of hangman like every kid plays at recess or, you know, whatever. But just the what's lurking beyond is just what makes that such an upsetting and affecting and an incredible piece of writing.
Thank you.
Cannot wait to read the whole thing.
Oh, thank you.
And I know that's just a small piece, and all the things that you talk about wanting it to pass on to the next generation and wanting to share your story. And I know so many people are going to identify with this, with ideas of historical trauma and all of that. And I hope that, you know, yours is one of those pieces that leads to a lot more conversation, like you talked about, and hopefully the silence starts to dissipate for sure. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I almost hesitate to ask this question, but what's next? you're like, I just want to concentrate on now.
Minute by minute. Asked me that the other day, day to day, just getting at it, getting through the day. But I do have a little idea, seed that's germinating. And I think there's something there, some juice there, because of several times now I've, I wake up and I think about it. I did journal about it a little bit here and there, and I think it's timely. I don't know yet if it'll turn out to be nonfiction or fiction, but it has to do with friendship. I'll just say that.
Nice. Well, you know, the book has gotten all kinds of great blurbs, all kinds of great advanced praise. And just in reading all the pieces, hearing your stories, there's no doubt that it's going to be a great read. And again, April 20th, We Are Bridges is the memoir. And, you know, in my little way, I'll be sure to spread the word and put it up on the website and all the above. And I just wish you continued great luck with your writing. Thanks so much again for making time today.
Oh, thank you so much, Pete. This was wonderful. I enjoyed time with you.
Such a pleasure. Such a pleasure. Thank you for listening to episode 53 with Cassandra Lane. You can now subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, and please leave me a 5-star review. You can also ask for the podcast by name using Alexa and find the pod on Stitcher, Spotify, and on Amazon Music. Follow me on Instagram, where I'm at Chills at Will Podcast, or on Twitter, where I'm at Chills at Will PO1. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills of Will podcast is Wind Down instrumental version. And the other song played on this episode was Hoops instrumental by Matt Whitehour. And both great songs are used through archesaudio.com. For now, thanks again for listening. And I hope these quarantine days bring you texts by writers and creatives with mad skills, like Cassandra Lane, whose We Are Bridges, a memoir, and other work gives you chills at will. Thank you.